Hello, everyone. I'll go through a recap and I will correct one statement I made, like I will sharpen it because I realized I was a bit too vague. And then we'll jump into the new things. So one thing that I should have mentioned is that most of what we do, first, at least to my knowledge, in more or less the same language appearing in this paper by Lee and Wald in 1991. So we saw that if we have a Lagrangian symmetry, which you remember means that the variation of the Lagrangian is a pure boundary term, then Noether's first theorem tells us that there is a current called the Noether current, which is whose divergence is proportional to the equations of motion and therefore is conserved on shell. So this answers the usual story that whenever you have a symmetry, you have some conserved quantity, and this quantity is obtained by integrating the current over your Cauchy hypersurface. Next, there is another story that is often told, which is you have the symmetries and they have conserved charges, and these conserved charges usually are the symmetries generators. So how does that work? Well, this is the statement I want to sharpen from last time. So one can derive, and I will update the notes to have this derivation in case you're interested, but I will not do it today. You can prove that the so of course this is the would be the candidate. What we would like to have is this formula, right? We have that the contraction of the symmetry with our covariant symplectic structure gives us the variation of the current. This is not possible in general. However, one can prove that this is true up to possibly two problems. The first problem is a bulk problem, but this problem vanishes on shell. So once we go on shell, this problem always drops, and so we are left with possibly some corner charge, some corner obstruction to the flow. Well, I never use the word corner, sorry, but possible obstruction. Let me maybe integrate this. Let's integrate over sigma. So this tells us that rho psi omega sigma is equal to minus what I called Q, which is the integral of J, plus a term that vanishes on shell, plus a boundary term on the boundary of sigma, which in general there's nothing we can do about. So two things. First thing, if sigma is a Cauchy surface, so it has no boundary, this last problem doesn't, it drops. So if, which means that on shell, we always have the equation we desire. Okay. However, there could be complications, possible complications. At this boundary. But we will not really talk too much about them, just a little bit later on. Now, one thing which is important about this, is that is about the covariant phase space. So you will remember that on shell, the space of solutions with this symplectic structure pulled back on the space of solution is our candidate symplectic phase space. So on that phase space, we always have this relationship for the at the level of the Cauchy surface. So the full phase space always carry a symmetry generator of a Lagrangian symmetry. So consequence, so of course with d sigma equals zero, always carry a Hamiltonian generator. Okay, so this is very important, and I misstated it a bit last time, so I wanted to make it more precise. This will have also another consequence that we will see in a moment. Now, after this, we say that, oh, there is a best case scenario when we have, well, we said it before that when both L is invariant and theta is gauge invariant, then it's clear that these two problems do not appear. And we say that this is the case in certain theories like Young-Mills. But we also saw for Young-Mills, like rotations for a particle or the gauge transformation for Young-Mills theory, as we will see in the tutorial. Now, we also saw an example, which is space-time translations in the case of a scalar field. And we saw that in that case, this off-shell obstruction arises. But it was proportional to box of phi, which drops on shell. So if you remember, we did it explicitly last time, so I'm not going to write it. But again, this is not super exotic, and we will see that it appears also in gravity. Okay. And I will say it again when we get there. So Noether, and then we proved also Noether 2, which says that this is about local Lagrangian symmetry. So now I will use a capital G. So for local symmetries, all I said so far also holds, but we have extra properties which we'll finish to investigate today. So this is a local Lagrangian symmetry. And by local, one means that psi can be chosen freely pointwise on our manifold. So in this case, Noether 2 says that we have a local Lagrangian symmetry, and we write delta psi phi I. We introduced this generic differential, well, this operator that is just a way that tells us, oh, in general, our field changes in this way, must be linear in psi, of course. So this can be field dependent, for example, in Young-Mills, if this is the connection, this would be the covariant derivative. The result of the theorem is that there is a related operator, which is an adjoint, essentially just an integration by parts of this one that applied to the equations of motion gives identically zero. So this is an off-shell statement. And we finished here last time. So let's give a couple of examples of this before discussing the consequences. So in Maxwell theory, what does Noether 2 say? So these are examples of Noether 2. It's a statement about the fact, it's just a statement about the antisymmetry of FAB. So these are the equations of motion in Young-Mills. And so this equation. So in Young-Mills, you would get the same, except that now it's about covariant derivatives. So it's a bit of a slightly less trivial situation, because now these are covariant derivatives, so maybe it's a bit less obvious that it works the same, because here it's just antisymmetry and so on, but it does. And so we see that we have a number of equations that tells there are alpha the number of relations that we have between the equations of motion is the dimension of the Lie algebra. So because there is this free index here that we see over there. And in GR, the relevant equation is GAB equals 0. So the Bianchi identity for GR. No, these are these equations, are examples of, so the equations of motion are GAB equal to 0, divergence of F equal to 0, and this is this one. So you see in Young-Mills or in Maxwell, what is delta A? Delta Xi A would be gradient, well, covariant derivative of Xi. The adjoint operator is the associated divergence. So this adjoint is the divergence operator, which I apply to the equations of motion. And same here, except that is the covariant one, and same thing here, in fact. So the structure is the same, because in all this theory, delta xi of the field is some derivative of the parameter, some covariant derivative of the parameter in the appropriate sense, and so they all have the same structure. So these are this and these are the equations of motion.
So is it correct to say that off-shell they define a cohomology, the equations of motion?
Well, to have that, you would need to tell me how to apply this twice, three times, and so on. Whereas here is more like a divergence. You apply it once, and then there's... So I'm not sure if there is... Well, there is a sense in which you can do a cohomology theory where the equations of motion are on the same footing as the gauge transformations. That's a Batali-Wilkowski formalism, but it's not what we're doing here. It's something much, much more basic.
Like from the Maxwell and Young-Mills case, it seems that the Euler-Lagrange constraint mm-hmm. is closed but not necessarily exact. But when it's exact, the equations of motion are true. Like FAB is closed. When FAB is exact, the Euler-Lagrange equation is true. But in general.
Yeah, I'm not. I would have. Yeah, I don't know how to make this precise. I don't know it on top of my head. The point there is an important difference at this. Well, at the level of this formalism, maybe not at the level of the physics, but at the level of this formalism, there is an important difference between E being equal to zero as an equation of motion and these equations, which are true identically. So this is just, if FAB is anti-symmetric, this is true. This is just about the anti-symmetry of FAB. And so these don't tell me anything about the dynamics. They tell me about the field content and its symmetries. So I could add, I could change my equations of motion and still get this type of symmetries as long as the field content is the same and the symmetries are respected. But the consequence of these for what we're interested in is that this tells us that there are not enough equations of motion to evolve our fields. So this is a very important consequence. And therefore, the dynamics is underdetermined. Same data can evolve, can be made evolve to different configurations. Now, how do you take care of this problem? Well, you identify all these configurations, essentially. That's a way to deal with this problem. So you could, we will see in a moment that the naive, in fact, this is related to the fact that the naive phase space of our theory, which is this one, is actually not the right answer for a gauge theory, because this object will end up being degenerate. So all these things are related. They all come from the locality of the symmetry. So it means that our naive, what we think is our phase space, in fact, is too big. And so here, this is a way of seeing that. We will see in a second another one.
Is there any way to see this constant one?
Just a second.
Is there an easy way to see this consequence? Just because the derivatives of the Euler Lagrange expressions are off shell zero, what does that mean that same data can evolve to different configurations?
Well, you are free to perform gauge transformations. The answer is this. You are free to perform gauge transformations to your initial data, and these transformations can be trivial on the initial surface and just be supported in the future. But this will generate a plethora of solutions of the equations of motion, which are all gauge related. So eventually you will know that you will want to identify them. But if you didn't know that you had a gauge symmetry, you might think, my equations of motion are underdetermining my dynamics, because I can evolve the same data in many different ways. Right? I can have a AA of X and T, or AA of X T plus, which is equal to the old one, plus something. And these can only appear later in the future. So same initial data, same initial value, same initial derivative, but they will differ in the future. But they're both solutions of the equations of motion. So this is what is secretly going on. How do you see it from there? It's not super obvious that this is what's going on. But this is definitely something that is happening, because we proved that the equations of motion are symmetry invariant, so we know that if one is a symmetry, a solution, all those will also be solutions. Okay, so next, so we prove this simple lemma, but it's super important. And this lemma tells us that if we have a local symmetry, and we are on a Cauchy surface. So you see, to evolve the initial data, you always need the entire Cauchy surface. That's why I'm in all these discussions, the right thing to assume, it's quite correct to assume this. It's not a restrictive hypothesis. We're talking about evolution of initial data, so it's right to take the entire Cauchy surface. Then Q sigma psi is equal to zero on shell. How do we prove this? Well, it's quite easy. One starts from, it's a consequence of Noether theorem and the locality of the first theorem and the locality of the symmetry. So how do we do it? Well, we say this is Noether 1, where we integrate dj xi, but this we know to be q sigma final of xi minus q sigma initial of xi. And this holds for all xi's, right? For all xi in G. But now we can choose this xi as we like. Choose xi. So you can choose xi arbitrary on in a neighborhood of sigma initial and vanishing in a neighborhood of sigma final. And doing so, of course, we obtain immediately that this is zero, but there was, from the point of view of sigma initial, xi was completely arbitrary, and so this is how. And one concludes from the fact that the sigma one chooses is completely arbitrary as well. So the conservation of a gauge charge must imply that the charge vanishes. Of the charge of a local symmetry must imply that it vanishes. Now, I give a theorem which is essentially a consequence of, can be seen as a consequence of this, or maybe, well, is some essentially equivalent to this, but is given in a more refined manner, and I will give it without proof. Actually, no. Let's keep working on this a second longer. Maybe it's okay. What is the consequence of this? Corollary. The corollary. We go back and look at what is it? This equation. And we say, but if Q is zero on shell, it means that omega sigma must be degenerate on shell. along the symmetries. By which I mean, more technically, that rho xi is in the kernel of the on-shell symplectic structure. So it's not a symplectic structure. That's the point. So it means that to obtain a symplectic structure, at the very least, we have to, well, in fact, it's also enough. One can, well, since we're in infinite dimension, you cannot really prove that in generality that this is all the kernel, but this is what you expect. So it becomes a problem of functional analysis, which are subtle and depends how you define things and so on and so forth. But morally speaking, this is all the kernel there is. And so to find a symplectic structure, to find a symplectic space, need to quotient out the local symmetry. So we never postulated that we had to quotient out a local symmetry to obtain physical configurations. It's somehow a consequence of the theory, of the mathematics, if you require that the right way of thinking about the phase space is to be non-degenerate. Of course, you are assuming something somewhere, so you cannot prove something out of nothing. So here, this is our hypothesis, that this is the right concept of phase space, is to be symplectic, and symplectic in particular means non-degenerate. And the only way for this to be possible in a gauge theory, so a theory with local symmetries, is to identify gauge-related configurations. Okay, so this somehow chimes with this other observation, because we are removing the same amount of directions in field space. Good. So this also, questions up to here? So this is an important result, of course, probably not too surprising, because we have seen it in many different ways, but this is a way to deduce it out of just the phase space properties of these theories. Now, you could, from this, we can say, oh, we just talked about Q, what about J? So what does it mean for Q to vanish on shell in the absence of boundaries when we have, what can we deduce from this at the level of J, of the current? So this, so this is what I want to discuss next. So I'll skip that part of the blackboard. So remember, we use this notation. Delta xi of phi I is di alpha alpha, by which, if I want to be a bit more, to see a bit more of the details, like last time, we wrote it in this way. So there is a part that depends on xi linearly and one that depends on its derivative. So from Noether 1, Noether 1 was telling us that, let me introduce a notation for this B. So you see, it looks like a vector. A vector I can also think as a three form by dualizing. So I introduce the associated form, which is defined as the Hodge dual of I take down the index. DXP. So I define the associated one form, take down the index. So it's the usual trick that we use to think about the neuter current as a three form or as a vector. It is the same type of manipulation, but this allows me to write things a bit more easily here. So locals, again, we have a local symmetry. Then jxi is equal to ei bi alpha xi alpha plus possibly an exact form. So we see that I want to define to give a name to the bulk part of my current. Okay, and if I care about the charges, so is what will end up in my phase space, right? Because my phase space is all, I obtain things on phase space when I pull back to a surface sigma and go on shell. So of course, this on shell will vanish. And I also want to give the following definition, which is sigma alpha, which is the pullback to sigma of this. And this is called the constraint. So I'm just differentiated between the spacetime piece and the piece pulled back to sigma, because it's slightly nicer. So what is it? So if I think of this now, it's a top form on sigma. So I can think of it as a scalar on sigma by duality. And so I can write it in terms of this B is alpha, and this index, the spacetime index, is contracted with the normal to the surface. So it's essentially some piece obtained by taking some normal directions in the equations of motion. I will write it for gravity, Young-Mills, in a second. So the way I would leave the proof. I think I will leave the proof for reasons of time, but I will type it later today or tomorrow at most on the notes, and you can look it there. The idea is. Let me do the sketch. Using neuter 1, we know that dj xi is equal to ed xi. But we can write this also as, by integrating by parts, we can write it like this, because b is the one that contains the derivative. So if we try to pull it out, we get the adjoint operator acting on the equations of motion and this boundary term. But now this we know to be 0 by neuter 2. And so we know that J is equal to this, because this is the divergence of J, right? It's the same thing. So the idea is that these two are equal up to something, up to a curl essentially, right? So we can write this in form as D of J minus E big psi equals zero. So these two are equal up to D of something. So the only thing that that's correct. So let's look at some examples. So Yang-Mills will be done in detail in the tutorial, but I still want to show you what these various objects are. So example. Well, are there questions about the theory first? So let's do Yang-Mills. In Yang-Mills, what is the current J? The current J is FAB covariant derivative of psi. So we see that if we integrate this by parts, which is a very similar operation that we had done to find the Noether 2, in fact, so that's why, we find the equations of motion. So we write these as we find dB FAB times psi. This is also valued in there is a trace. Sorry, I should have written the trace. JA equal minus trace of this, the minus appears here, if I remember correctly, plus, now there is a total divergence, because I'm integrating by, parts of trace of FAB psi. And now we recognize this is a piece of the equations of motion. Well, it's the equations of motion, essentially. In this case, this B turns out to be kind of trivial. So this is my C alpha. So this is C alpha. And little j is this object here. So this is JAB. So you see this is big J is a top minus 1 form. This is a top minus 2 form. So it will have two indices in the vector form, in the vector notation. And then the charge will therefore be minus the trace of my constraint, which is the normal part You write it like this, N A D D F A B of Xi. So this will be the Gauss constraint. Plus the boundary term, which is writing things appropriately. I believe one should get a trace of FAB Xi Epsilon AB, which is the double, the binormal, right? You remember the binormal? So the 1/2 I think is correct, but depends on how one defines this essentially. Yes.
What's the difference between D and nabla?
Ah, yeah. So this this is the covariant derivative. This is just it's written here. So this knows nothing. This is a scalar, has no Young-Mills indices, internal indices, Lie algebra indices. They're all contracted by the trace. So the only thing I can apply is, if you want, in this formula, this is a tensor, a two-tensor, but with no Lie algebra indices. So the only thing I can apply to it is a covariant derivative in the sense of space-time, but not in the sense of Young-Mills. Whereas here, this is really dB Xi alpha plus AB, well, Xi D. But since this is a scalar, I can also think of it like this. It doesn't change. And here, but here, since it's a divergence, it's important it to be a nabla and not a partial derivative, unless you're in flat space then.
It's not clear to me when we take integration by parts why the covariant derivative becomes...
This is the tutorial of this afternoon. So, but covariant derivatives integrate by parts nicely inside the trace, but what you can get out... So this is F, then there is a covariant derivative plus A Xi. So this piece integrates by part as usual. Here there is no derivative. So it's just a matter of reshuffling where the bracket acts. So it will not contribute to the boundary term for sure, but it does work nicely that this can be written like that. If you want things to look covariant, that's the only thing that can happen. They must be covariant both in space-time and in the Lie algebra space. So there is not much else that is possible. Very good. So these on so and this is what this is the this is okay. What did I want to say? Yeah, this is. This together with that gives me the electric flux smeared with Xi, but this will pick the electric flux component. Through partial sigma, which remember is this corner. Well, there are too many C's, but is the corner of the manifold. How to see that this is the Gauss constraint? Let's just imagine for a second that we're in flat spacetime. So this goes to pick the divergence of F0. So this must be tangent index. So this is the divergence of F0i, which is E. So this is the divergence of E. So it will be the Gauss constraint. Then, in general, one has to work a bit harder because one should do a 3+1 split, so and so on. So it can be a bit messy on general on a general surface, but just as a sanity check in flat space, this gives us immediately the divergence of the electric field. And this is F0z, let's say. So it's also an electric field. This is the binormal, right? So it's something that has a normal index both in time and in the space direction. So we have N S, and these together give me the epsilon. So this is F contracting both with both normals. So it's a normal component of the electric field. So this is also why we get the electric flux. Okay. Jackie, you had a question.
My question was about the binormal. This equation is independent of how you define it.
Yeah. So you can write it in form language. I think it's part of the tutorial. In the form language is actually a bit, it's even simpler. You would get Q is something like the trace of star F psi plus the integral of star F psi. Oops, so here there is a well, I should put the covariant D. but this is the, again, the constraint. And this is, here it's clear that written like this, F is a two form, star F is another two form, or top minus two form. This is a top minus two manifold. So this has nothing to do on how I pick my coordinates. So it's intrinsic.
But in practice, it will be normalized?
This might not. Oh, this? Oh, yeah, how I defined it at the beginning is done in a way that it's normal. I think it has a norm 2 for because it's, yeah. Because it's the right thing that works when doing the decontraction games. Nico spent some time checking the conventions, and it seemed to work. Again, we'll try. We're a bit behind with updating the lecture notes, but it will go into the appendix, the conventions for that.
It's going to be finished by the end of the day.
Okay, good. Okay, in the last 10 minutes, I want to... Here I'm trying to recoup some time that I'm a bit behind the lecture, so today it's been a bit fast, but I wanted to start GR, so next time we can actually have some more interesting... interesting topics. We can start talking about Walt's, the other Walt paper, the one about the Noether entropy. Okay, the black hole entropy as a Noether charge. So this is mostly to fix conventions. So there are so I will write it like this with L. I want sometimes it's useful in to split it into the scalar piece and the volume form. So this is now a scalar. And it's equal to conventions, 1/2 R minus, well, yes, 1/2 R minus lambda. Whereas epsilon is the volume form, and it's equal to square root of G D for X. So D for X, I mean, dx0, wedge dx1, wedge dx2, etc. Now, as you probably have already seen, to have a well-defined action principle, this is not really a good action. So for, but we will not really care about this point because we never have to really use that. It gives us a well-defined action principle to do what we did so far. But it's a good thing to know, and it can change the corner charges slightly. So it's important to be aware of this. So for a well-defined action principle with fixed induced metric at the boundary, we need to add the York-Gibbon-Soaking boundary term. And Ruth has already discussed this in I'm sure in greater detail, so I will not insist on where H is the trace of the boundary curvature. Okay, but we will not add it. We will not So what is the problem? For those of you who haven't seen it, if I take a variation of this action, what happens is that the boundary term will not be something delta h. There will be also be derivatives acting on delta h, normal derivatives in particular. So it means that I would have to keep h and the time derivative of delta h and h fixed, and also its time derivative fixed to have a good action principle. But doing this at the same time is not possible to have good equations of motion. So it means that there's something that needs to be corrected, and this is the right boundary term to add in that case. There exist other action principles for GR, for example, action principle written in terms of the gammas instead of the curvature. Those also work, but there are different ways of doing things, but we will not really care much.
Just mean that we have Neumann boundary conditions?
Oh, with these? No, because these are mixed stuff. So to get Neumann, you would need to add something else. These are both delta H and delta H dot appearing. So it's neither one. That's a problem. It's not that they're not Dirichlet, but they're neither. Okay. So now the next thing is to introduce some conventions. They're not particularly interesting or difficult. It's just about what I mean when I write the variation of GAB with the indices up. This is not the variation of the inverse. What I mean by definition is I'm taking the variation of the metric as my basic object, and we know, why can I do this? Because I know this is a tensor. It's a tensor a bit like, the metric is a, it's just defined like this. So, and this happens to be minus the inverse, the variation of the inverse. That's why it's important. So this is an exercise to check. But this is what I mean. And the other thing is, in the same vein, when I write the variation of G, I mean the variation of the trace. The trace of the variation and not the variation of the determinant. Symmetries. Well, the symmetries of the action, we all know them. they are diffeomorphisms. So in this case, G rho R is equal to, so G, let's write it like this. G diffeos, what is the algebra of diffeos? Is vector fields on my manifold, where the Lie bracket in the algebra is the Lie bracket between the vector fields. So xi eta is equal to L xi of eta, which is minus L eta of xi. And the action rho xi applied to G, well, is d xi gab. But what is this delta xi of gab is equal to the Lie derivative of gab, which is the symmetrized covariant derivative of xi with the index low. Now, there are two important remarks, and then I will finish on these two. Remark one is that this action, unfortunately, is a non-homomorphism. So I would have to put weird minus signs here and there to fix it. It's not worth it. It's better to remember that. So if you happen to do computations explicitly for GR, at some point you will realize that some signs that you're used to do not appear all scrambled up. It's not you. It's really that these here you get the opposite sign. Just if you follow the definition, this is what you get. And there's nothing wrong with this. It's just a matter of left versus right actions. So. And the second remark, which is more conceptual, is that these diffeos should not be interpreted as changes in coordinates. Here we're changing the fields. So these diffeos act on field space, which is the space of metrics, not on M nor on XA. Okay? So these are changes in our fields that mimic changes of coordinates, if you want. But these are changes in the fields. Yes?
GR is diffeomorphism invariant, but that diffeomorphism is change in charts, not the change in metric itself.
No. These are changes in the metric. That's what I'm saying.
And we are saying that GR is diffeomorphism invariant. Mm-hmm. The diffeomorphism can be changes in the metric.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two are related. If you have a unique chart, you can always, locally, a change in coordinates correspond to a certain change of the metric with respect to the old coordinates. I remember Ruth having a full lecture trying to explain how Lie derivatives are defined very rigorously, and there, she was really saying, oh, I changed things in this way, but then I tried to undo it by changing in coordinates and the Lie derivative of what is left over, essentially. So here is the same idea. You can do a change in the field, which mimics what you would find as a change in coordinates as seen from the old coordinate system. So, but you don't need to to go there. You can. So in Yang-Mills, let's think about Yang-Mills. In Yang-Mills, you would say a gauge transformation is a change in the field. You can also think about it as some change in the way you take sections in the principal fiber bundle. And but it's not the way you really want to think about it in field space. You want to change what you want to think about your symmetries as relating different field configurations. So this is what we are doing here too. There are field configurations that are it's a bit. I just say it not to get confused when we write formulas in particular general covariance, which I wanted to cover, but I think it's too late. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So these changes in the metric are induced by coordinate transformation. There can be other changes in the metric which are physical. For example, if I put a massive particle in space-time. So these changes are basically directly dependent on coordinate transformation.
No, I want you to think about them as different. So it's not the way. So usually there are many ways of thinking about this. So you think about it as you like. But a possible way to think about this is, for now, let's think about the manifold, if you want, in a certain coordinate system, and what are all the possible metrics I can put on top of them. And some of them are different, but they are related by diffeomorphisms. So I want to keep my coordinate fixed and think about changes about diffeomorphism acting on the space of metrics, not on my coordinate grid. I keep my coordinate grid fixed and I change my metric field. There's always a way to rewrite things in a passive way as changes in coordinates, but I don't want to do that. I want to think of them as I have fixed the coordinates and I think about these fields. Now, following all this reasoning here, we see that we are forced to identify those metrics anyway if we want to have a phase space at the end. So there's the two point of view eventually are consistent. You could say that diffeo-related metrics give you the same physics. You could say all coordinates give you the same physics. In the end, it doesn't really matter which point of view you take, you prefer. But here, given how we're writing things, these are derivatives acting in field space, not on space-time. These diffeos are acting on my metric field, not on the coordinates. In the end, I want to identify metrics, not coordinate systems. But the two things are related. But it's what this equation says is on the space of a statement about the space of metrics.
Because the way you define the coefficient of this mm-hmm. field is precisely diffeomorphism.
Yeah.
Do you have a comment about the fact that it's just the piece of diffeomorphism that you can reach via a vector field? But the group of diffeomorphism, the group, not the algebra, but the group, is bigger than that.
So there are two problems with the diffeomorphism group. The first one, there is one technical problem is that the relationship between the group and the algebra is different than the usual gauge transformation we're used to for SU2 or others. In particular, not even a neighborhood of the of the identity element of the diffeomorphism group is covered by the exponential map. So the image of the exponential map doesn't even cover a neighborhood of, so it's scattered. You can still generate all the group elements by composing exponentiated version of vector fields, but the map is not onto the exponential map. So first problem that tells you that things are complicated. Then there is the second issue, which you could also see in gauge transformations, the usual ones, which is you could define the group as, depends how you define the group. You want the group to be everything and or just the identity component of the group. I've always, so what you find here when you study these type of problems, you find that it's only, here you're only identifying, you're only forced to identify metrics according to this reasoning that are related by infinitesimal gauge transformations, by sequences of infinitesimal gauge transformations. So only you're only quotienting out the identity component of the diffeomorphism group, or gauge, or the gauge group. This is very agnostic about what you should do about the global, the fact that there are potentially disconnected components of the gauge group. It doesn't tell you that you must identify them. That's a different axiom. It doesn't come with this. It is not required to have a phase-based structure. So this is something that happens in holography, for example, where you take large diffeomorphism of the boundary, and then these are related to different bulk space. But to me, it's not super. Not, let's say from this reasoning, there's no obvious answer. You're free to decide to identify metrics that are related by large diffeomorphism or not. This doesn't tell you. So you can do what works better, I suppose. But in Young Mills, theta vacua could be seen as, in fact, as due to the fact that these connected components of your gauge group, in fact, can still act non-trivially on your states. So in gauge theories, you might not want to think of quotient out the large gauge transformations.